When I've talked to people that have done all these, and especially ayahuasca is the clearest, over and over again, everyone says that at some point in time they interact with a serpent entity. It is one of the most common experiences that there are. Atheistic scientists have tried to speculate on what that might be and the reason why people always see serpents, but it is a very, very common thing. Science, philosophy, and theology all kind of point to there being other dimensions with the possibility of things being in those other dimensions. So the interesting thing about Christianity is no use of drugs for spiritual purposes, no transcendental meditation, no practices of like trying to get your average Christian up into that spiritual world. It like didn't happen that way. And as a matter of fact, Christianity has kind of this flipping upside down of that, where instead of us having to go up and see the gods, our God came down to the physical state, and our sacraments, rather than being sacraments that are intended to take us to the spiritual world, it takes the spiritual world to us.
Hey everyone, it's Jennifer, and welcome to another episode of Connection. I am overcoming a bit of a bout with bronchitis, which I have not had since I was about 13, so pardon the sultry phone sex voice. I suppose that's what I get for moving to a place that has winter. Anyway, enough of that. I'm so excited to bring you today's guest, Lewis Ungott. Lewis is author of the book entitled Return of the Dragon, in which he explores the way drugs, specifically psychedelics, which seem to be all the rage these days, and religion shape people and societies. Having spent a very tumultuous year of my own life under the spell of psychedelics, I was so excited to find someone who is sounding the alarm on their dangers and abuse. Despite the fact many influential personalities have endorsed the use of plant medicines, I'm putting air quotes around the word medicine there, everyone from Joe Rogan to politicians, they are not the cure or the answer to complex psychological trauma some purport them to be. Lewis and I dive into it all, the dangers and the pitfalls of psychedelics, as well as their associations with Christianity and why Christians should be very skeptical of them. We also discuss what policy solutions, if any, should be enacted. Man, I am so pumped to have you listen to this episode. So without further ado, I bring you Lewis Ungott. I am so curious because I don't know much about you. I've read your writings and I see you on Twitter and I've listened to a couple of the live things that you've done. But how does someone become so interested in psychedelics, religion, and spirituality? What's your story, dude? Like, how did you get here?
My background, my undergraduate was in engineering. I ended up getting a business degree, master's of business, and then I actually went to seminary and got a seminary degree. So a very varied background, science and economics and theology and all that. So I was always very interested in religion, just read deeply on religion, that kind of stuff. But also just interested in culture, interested in politics. I mean, you see what I talk about a lot of times is politics and religion and culture and all those things, which all in many ways go together, blend together when you think about it. It's hard to separate one from the other. But somewhere as I was kind of just paying attention to where the culture was going, I started to notice the growth of psychedelic movement here today. I think a lot of that goes to like Joe Rogan, but there's other people like Graham Hancock, who's a famous author, did a series on Netflix. Michael Pollan is a best-selling author. He's talked about it as well. Older authors like Terence McKenna have talked about this in depth. And I started noticing just like here in Michigan, we have our pot laws. They just rolled them all back and now it's perfectly legal. People advertise this on billboards. You smell pot walking down the street. It's just as widespread as it could be. And it's not just pot, it's other drugs as well. But the thing, and I talk about this at the beginning of my book, but the thing that really got me interested in it was I started to hear about this one particular psychedelic called ayahuasca, the chemical active ingredient is DMT, dimethyltryptamine. But I started to hear about that, and what I heard about it was unbelievable. Like, you almost think it has to be fake. Like, people go to, you know, they take this drug and they all see the same things. They all see these heavenly geometries that they talk about that look kind of like Aztec shapes and forms. You all see these entities that they describe as elves or sometimes machine elves is one of the things they talk about with that. And it's true across cultures. It's not like a cultural thing. You know, if you're a hippie from New York City or a businessman from Australia or an Aboriginal indigenous person, and you take this drug, almost everybody describes the same thing. And so I thought that was amazingly interesting. But what was very interesting about it was that people come down from their high, mm-hmm. and they say that was real. So mm-hmm. not while they're still, you know, we all, you know, you take a nap and you dream of stuff and then you wake up and nobody says that was real, right? Nobody says I had that, those crazy things that happened to me in the dream were real. But when people take DMT and they come down, they say those entities that I talked with continue to exist. And I found that fascinating. Like, I found it super interesting. And then the thing I thought about is, like, if they are real, if, you know, if it's possible, is it possible they're real? And if it is, what are they? So that was kind of like the premise of my book and where I really started research is, like, what exactly is going on? Is it real? And if it is, what could it be? What could an interpretation be? And in particular, as I mentioned, interested in religion, like, what's the religious history on this? And, like, how does this factor into the pagan religions of the past, as well as Christianity? You know, and, you know, as I mentioned to you earlier, I am a Christian, but how does this factor into Christianity? And so those are the things that I kind of started to go down that route when I started researching for this book. And it took me a couple of years to write it. But I think it's the results were fascinating. I didn't expect what I got when I had done all the research. By the end, I was very surprised to come to the conclusions I came to. And I think the response to the book has been really fun as well, with lots of people finding it very important to them. It's been edifying to me that so many people have reached out and said how useful and helpful it was for them to kind of understand this issue more than it was. And it's also, in some ways, for me, served as like this necessary warning for culture and society. Like, I feel Christianity is very active on a lot of social issues. You think about questions around sexuality or questions around abortion, very active, surprisingly not active around the question of drugs. And to the point of, you know, some Christians do. I've talked to Christians that are like, hey, I smoke pot or whatever. And so it's surprisingly a gap kind of in Christian social thinking that, you know, in my small way, I hope my book can kind of help fill that gap.
Yeah. And we'll get to the book. I want to back up a little bit, but with two questions. Of course, you delving into this research begs the question, have you done ayahuasca? But what, let's back up. That's an important one, but I also want to know, like, have you always had a spiritual impulse as a child? Like, was that something that was always in you? Cause I'm always curious as to, like, how people find religion or what draws them to spirituality. Was there an impulse from when you were younger? There was something you couldn't get your finger on or something that happened in your life that turned you towards religion? Did you grow up with it?
My background, my parents were always, I would say, religious as a small child, but they did a variety of different things as, you know, as a child. They went through kind of like everything from atheism to tried the kind of weird stuff like Christian Scientism. When I was a teenager, they became Catholics. That in some ways didn't really click for me as a teenager. And it wasn't until college that I really started to seriously think about religion. That's where like I started to read the Bible and started to, I came to faith and really in a serious way came to faith. And, you know, from there went to seminary and that kind of thing. So yeah, it was really in discussions in college that I think the whole religious question for me really took on importance. As a kid, you know, I think in some ways, like every kid, I think is religious, where every kid like kind of just has this blind trust in God and trust in the universe. And, you know, I think I certainly had that to some degree or another, but I never, in terms of like intellectually thinking about these things, I don't know that I really thought too deeply about it until I was in college.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds more like it became an intellectual pursuit for you than like a heart pursuit at first. You know, I don't know where you are now, but that like, you know, I think people come to it through different avenues. I know I came to it because I was, I think, spiritually sick. You know, I think I was looking for a home. I was looking for a place I fit in. I didn't feel like I fit in with my family and the way I was raised. And it was kind of a rebellious thing. You know, I'm going to go out to California as far away as I can from my family. And but it sounds like yours was definitely like there was an intellectual curiosity about it. I think there has to be if you're going to go to school for theology, you know, there has to be a real curiosity to get in and study what this is.
I think for sure it's that was an element to it, but you know, I think there always is that heart issue as well. I think there's that need for God in your life, that gap that doesn't get filled by anything but God. So I do think that heart issue for me, as well as everybody, is there, or we're all striving for good things in life. We're all striving for fulfillment. And I think until you recognize that only God can fill that hole, I think people are going to continue striving and finding a gap between what they need and what is reality. So yeah, for me, the intellectual piece, I think is my personality or whatever, is something I think about. But I do think there's a heart issue that, you know, as well, that, yeah.
The God-shaped hole in our heart, right?
Yes.
They're looking for things, and part of the things they're finding they're drugs. What we're talking about are drugs, right? Like they can call them plant medicines, they can call them spirits, they can call them Mother Aya and put like a personality on it, like, you know, the goddess or whatever. But they're drugs.
Yeah, I think that there's a book by Rodney Stark. He's a sociologist, actually just passed away, but he was a sociologist at Baylor University, and he wrote a book called The Triumph of Faith. And his argument that he makes in that book is essentially that people are always religious. Even you go to the most secular countries in the world, and they have non-materialistic views. Like if you do a poll on like, do you believe in prayer, or do you believe in ghosts, or do you believe in, so you know, if you just take a poll of their views, there it's not like they're all Richard Dawkins in France or in Iceland or Japan or whatever. They have religious views. What he says is the only difference between, say, a what we would call a religious country, maybe to some degree the US or an Eastern European Orthodox country or whatever, that where people go to church and that kind of thing, and a place like France where people generally speaking don't go to church, these are the big differences: organized religion versus disorganized religion. So what people end up in the absence of having an organized faith, where the church leaders establish what's authorized belief versus not authorized belief, in the absence of that, people just start believing crazy stuff, right? They start testing stuff. They start getting superstitious. They start believing in ghosts, believing in the occult, trying spiritualism, and the use of drugs historically in the history of the world. And I do talk about this in my book, was a very central to religious experience for most people. So you go around the history of the world, say pre-Christianity, and the use of drugs for spiritual purposes was incredibly normal. So what you're seeing in the US as some of the institutional church loses credibility, loses influence in society, what you end up seeing is people embracing this disorganized religion, which is things like yoga, things like spiritualism, going to seances, doing palm readings, and drugs is absolutely part of that. So they embrace all of that, and then they also say, let's try ayahuasca journey. Let's go down to the Amazon, find a witch doctor, and do an ayahuasca journey. And that is absolutely part of this disorganized religion that we have that's flourishing, absolutely flourishing. Yeah. So, that question of like young people, I think to some degree you're right that they're not asking traditional Christian questions that people born into a more traditional Christian society would ask. But I think they do have that hunger for something spiritual. Mm-hmm. I think that's where these drugs come in.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny you said yoga. I mean, I don't know if you know, I was a yoga teacher I still am. I still teach yoga. I definitely have a different perspective on it now, a different approach since I've been a Christian. And to me, like when I was really into it, it was a religion. And I said, well, you can't practice yoga without practicing Hinduism for the most part, or some sort of, Indian spiritual practice,
it's an interesting thing. And I actually didn't know that, but that is,
yeah, it's okay.
No judgments, of course, but but it is interesting that, a lot of that stuff did come in just over the last century. Like there was no people in the Shakespearean times doing yoga, It really came into the West, whether it was yoga, whether it was transcendental meditation, whether it was mantra meditation, mindfulness is one of the other things you hear about. All those things kind of came in over the last century. And it's hard to, there's a little bit of chicken and the egg thing where you don't know, did the church start to lose credibility because those things came in, or did those things come in because the church lost credibility? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. Maybe a combination of those two things.
I think there's always a push and a pull. Yeah, definitely a push and a pull. I mean, listen, this is your podcast, not mine, but I can definitely speak to the slippery slope of, I'll go do yoga and then I'll do. Next thing you know, you're in an ayahuasca ceremony, not necessarily in the Amazon, in downtown Los Angeles, and it can all become very destabilizing, which, you talk a lot about that. It's like a lot of these things are accompanied by or acquainted with death and destruction, right? Like what's the, you keep using, I'm going to open my notes. I love like you keep asking the question that you keep making the statement, drugs for spiritual purposes, serpent gods and slaughter of innocents. Like you see that in every historical culture.
Yes. Yeah.
That triumvirate of things that go together.
Yeah. It is amazing how that kind of three things you see over and over and over again. One of the clearest is the Aztecs, that when the Spanish showed up to, on the beaches of what is now Mexico, and encountered the Aztecs, they saw them taking mushrooms, eating these mushrooms, and they saw them losing their minds, talking to devils, interacting, being able to predict the future, that kind of thing, using these mushrooms. So that was like a part of their spirituality, and the Spanish wrote about this. And then in addition to that, of course, we all know that the Aztecs were brutal when it came to human sacrifice, thousands and thousands. I mean, some estimates are as high as hundreds of thousands a year that they would practice human sacrifice on. And their god was a feathered serpent. That's just like, so just like that, those three you see very clearly. But it's not just the Aztecs. You see it, the Inca have it. You see the Vikings have those three. You see in the ancient Near East that the Bible kind of was written in the gods that they were interacting with. Many of those were serpent gods. That's a lot of, like, if you're familiar with the story of Moses, where he goes and interacts with the Egyptians, and part of it is his staff turns into a serpent. Part of that was the serpents were, at least some of their pantheon of gods were serpents. So it is an interesting thing that we see that over and over again when we look at history. And I don't think it's coincidental.
Why not?
Well, one of the things that, you know, in my book I talk about is the fact that when people do these drugs for spiritual purposes, when people engage in, and I've talked to people that have done LSD, I've talked to people that have done mushrooms, and I've talked to people even that have done heavy doses of marijuana. That's one of the interesting things about pot is a lot of people think of pot as like this mild thing where you don't really feel anything. You know, people will say, oh, I smoked a joint once, I didn't even feel anything or whatever. And I think the people that tried it in the, say, pre-1990s versus people that try it now, it's a whole different thing. THC levels have multiplied as much as 10 times. The active ingredient in the pot. So anyway,
that's the for people that don't know, the THC is the hallucinogenic agent, right? Of marijuana.
That's correct. Yeah. Yep. Yes. And so I'll get back to my point with the serpents is, so I've talked to people that have done all these, and especially ayahuasca is the clearest. Over and over again, everyone says that at some point in time, they interact with a serpent entity. It is one of the most common experiences that there are. Atheistic scientists have tried to speculate on what that might be, the reason why people always see serpents. But it is a very, very common thing. Graham Hancock, who I mentioned earlier, says that he regularly interacts with what he calls Mother Ayahuasca. And it's a woman serpent hybrid that gives him wisdom and directs him and that kind of thing. So this universal experience of the serpent, I think is very indicative of hallucinogenic drug use. And we just see that throughout history. And it's, like I had mentioned before, the use of drugs for spiritual purposes is also almost universal. So it makes sense that people are taking these drugs as part of their religion. They're interacting with these serpents as part of their religion. And then the last piece, which is the human sacrifice piece, is I think also not coincidental. There's a book by Leslie Wilson, who was a scholar at Yale, and he wrote, I think the book is called The Serpent Symbol in the Ancient Near East, but he talked about the fact that the serpent god and human sacrifice in the ancient Near East always went together. The serpent god was the one that asked for human sacrifice. So it is, those three are tied together. In my book, I try to link those a little bit, but also let the reader kind of make their own linkages and come to their own conclusions on it. But like I said, I don't think it's coincidental that those three go together.
I mean, obviously in our religion, in Christianity, it's essential to the beginning of time, to the story, to the fall. I think you kind of allude to this in the book, if not outright say it, is that if this serpent is present in all religions, is this real? Is there something that's not just a mythological creature, but there's something real to the devil, the serpent, evil? Am I right in saying that that's what you're
absolutely
kind of questioning?
Yeah. So one of the interesting things that happens, like if Johns Hopkins has done in-depth studies on how people respond to DMT. University of Wisconsin-Madison, New York University has, and you read those studies and it's very interesting. And I mentioned this earlier, is that people come back and they say that was real. Like what I saw was real. And so I spend a lot of time in my book talking about, you know, is it possible these things are real? Is it possible they're, do we have to like just assume that everybody comes back, sobers up, and yet somehow something in their brain is broken where they can't figure out that it wasn't real? Or should we like trust these people? Like, is what they're saying, is it trustworthy? Is it something that we can kind of think about? And I talk about like, how could it be real? Like, what could be going on with that? And I really look at it from a scientific standpoint, from a philosophical standpoint, and from a theological standpoint. So from a scientific standpoint, there are certainly theories in quantum physics that talk about the fact that there's multiple dimensions, that there's up to 10 different dimensions, according to most quantum theorists talk about. And within those dimensions, one of the possibilities is that there's dark matter there. So in other words, they're not just empty dimensions. They're real dimensions that we just can't see into. So that's a scientific place. And then philosophically, I talk about the fact that there's always been this sense of this place of the gods within philosophy. You go back to Plato, you go back to Aristotle, you look at the Stoics, they all had kind of this multi-tier level of divinity and other dimensions within those divinities. And then I talk about the fact that within Christianity, we've also got this idea of dimensions, that heaven in many ways is not a place physically, it is a dimension that we can be in or not be in. And so, like, ultimately, I think there's, if an idea builds strength from multiple different disciplines looking at it and seeing it, I think I would say at least it's possible that these things are real. At least it's possible there's some other dimension. And, you know, when people talk about, like, the possibility of it being real, like Graham Hancock talks about this, as he argues that maybe consciousness, we're able to tune our consciousness to either see into or not see into those other dimensions. And maybe these drugs modify something in such a way that we can see into these other dimensions. And so I think that's something that when you tie all that together, that people say it's real, people, trustworthy, smart, intelligent people come back and they say, yes, that was real. And it continues to be real, even though I've sobered up. And then there's all the scientific, philosophical, theological reasons to believe that it's at least possible that it's real. At that point in time, I say, yeah, we should actually take it seriously. In addition to that, like, there's wild things that I talk about in the book, is that there's things that are very hard to explain if it's not real. So in other words, there's entities that are able to say things that you wouldn't otherwise be able to know. There's telepathy that people are able to do, where they're able to know what's in each other's brains in a way that you wouldn't, if it was fake, if it was just a hallucination or a dream, it wouldn't be possible. People seeing things that, after they've sobered up, and seeing things that wouldn't otherwise be able to do. Out of body experiences that people have had, where they can see things in the room they shouldn't be able to see, those kind of things. Are all documented and recorded. And so there's a lot of aspects to this that are very hard to explain from a purely materialistic standpoint, but make a lot of sense if what I'm saying is true.
Yeah. So I don't want to jump over the question, and we can, I have another follow-up question, but so you have done something, right? Ayahuasca.
So I talk about this in the book. When I was in high school and early college, I certainly experimented with some of these things. I didn't do ayahuasca, but I did experiment with several of these hallucinogens. And I have. It's interesting. I think everybody reacts differently to these things. And so for some people, it's like this incredibly powerful thing that they want to continue doing to the point where they're almost addicted. For me, I got a weird bad feeling about it early on, and I just said, this is bad for me. I honestly think it was God protecting me, but I said, this is bad for me, it's bad for my soul. And like I said, I wasn't even spiritually minded back then, but I just was like, I shouldn't be doing this. And so I got like scared of it, and said, this, I should not continue doing this. And so I just stopped at that point in time. And that was way before I came to the conclusions I've come to here, like many, many years ago. But that was kind of the history of my usage of it. And, in some ways, like, I said this in the book, in some way, my experience probably was similar to a lot of people's, where you come down and you think you've got the world figured out. You think you like saw reality. You think you saw truth. You think you saw moral clarity. You think you understand what kind of the universe in perspective. So it seems profound to you. But like I said, just there was something about it for me that I felt like it was scrambling my mind and damaging my soul, that I just didn't continue doing it.
In the yogic model, there's these things called koshas, or layers, coverings of the soul, right? That kind of help us navigate the material world and the spiritual world, right? And that if we're too much in the spiritual world, which is what happens on a trip, right? You're kind of completely out of, physically sometimes out of body, the telepathy things, like you're in this whole other realm, like you're talking about. And the more consistently you use these things, those sheaths, those covering that protect the soul, right, that serve as a buffer between the spirit world and the material world, begin to thin, right? They begin to become not as perceptible. They begin to, you know, so now you're just completely out of touch with reality, really, and ungrounded and somewhat psychotic. I mean, that's what happened. By the time that year ended, I was just crazy. I don't even know how I held jobs. Like, I think, you know, the discipline I had and the structure I had growing up was always a really good buffer for me 20 years out in LA, right? I always was just like, no, but I have to work. Like, I have to have something. I had to support myself, first of all. So that was always good. But like, had I not had that, I would have ended up probably on the streets. Do you know what I mean? Like, you're in a.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. I think spiritual world, that's a great description that you gave, where it's like this lack of protection between you and reality. And you're going into this place where there's kind of this lack of grounding to the whole thing. And it's interesting. So one of the things I talk about in the book is the difference between Christianity and almost every other religion, because every other religion does have that element of like, how do you get, even if it's not using drugs, even if it is using meditation or whatever, it's like, how do you get up into that spiritual world? How do you get into see the angels or see the demons or whatever it is you're seeing, see those entities? How do you interact with those things? How do you leave your body so that you can go see things in other places? It is like getting out of the physical and getting into the spiritual. And the different Christianity is so different from those things. It's interesting. First of all, from day one, there was no use of drugs from day one. And one of the Joe Rogan had a guy on his show called Brian Murescu, who argued that Christianity in the early days did have psychedelic drugs. I addressed that in the book, and I also addressed that in a longer article on my website. It was complete garbage.
I heard you talk to, I listened to that podcast that you had with someone last night about that guy. I may have heard him in passing, but I was like, yeah.
So Christianity never had. Interesting thing about Christianity is no use of drugs for spiritual purposes, no transcendental meditation, no practices of like trying to get your average Christian up into that spiritual world. It like didn't happen that way. And as a matter of fact, Christianity has kind of this flipping upside down of that, where instead of us having to go up and see the gods, our God came down to the physical state, and our sacraments, rather than being sacraments that are intended to take us to the spiritual world, it takes the spiritual world to us. So it's like a flipping upside down of kind of every other religion, where it's grounding us more, not grounding us less. And it is a beautiful switch. So like people say, well, how, you know, within Christianity, how do you go see God? And, you know, I would say the right answer is like, we see God by walking into the nature and, you know, feeling the wind that is on our face, or feeling the rain that falls on our head, or smelling the sea. But we also see God by the sacraments, and we see God by our fellow Christians, and see God by serving the poor, and we see God. So like, we see God in this world. That's where we see God. We don't see God by trying to get to some other world. And Christianity, we have a creator God. We have a God that, you know, a lot of religions, the creation is the bad thing that we need to get away from. In Christianity, the creator God is the one that we should be worshiping. And so it is a very interesting split between the Christian religion and almost every other religion. And I think drugs is a big part of that. The use of drugs absolutely helps you get into that spirit world. And as Christians, we would say that's not the direction we should be going. We should be grounded in this world.
It's interesting, though, I have to say that your description, your definition, the picture you're painting of Christianity is my understanding of it from an Orthodox perspective. But I don't feel like that's even many Christians' understanding of it, right? This sensory, real, inexplicable presence of God. God is the Alpha, the Omega, the Logos, and the heart. Like, there's this, it's all encompassing, holistic. But like, I think the idea that most American people have of Christianity and why it's getting such a bad rap right now is that it is not inclusive of all of these mystical, I think you said you don't love this word, but transcendental, like, experiences in the present moment, right? It's just very heady, and it's very, these are the dogmas and the dog, you know, it doesn't leave any room for this holistic experience that you're talking about. And I don't think, like, when people are even hearing you talk about Christianity, they're even going to be like, that's not Christianity.
Yeah, and I think that there is a need within Christianity to remember, like the creed says, the resurrection of the dead, right? The creed says that the resurrection of Jesus, there's this element of the created life that we have. And that's one of the important things that I think a lot of people don't think about is, like, within, when someone dies, they say, well, they're in heaven now, you know, they're, you know, maybe they become an angel or whatever, like they've gone off to the spirit world. And in reality, in the end, for Christianity, the ultimate hope is not a disembodied state. The ultimate hope is resurrection. That's in the creeds, that's in the Bible, that's in, you know, John chapter 5, Daniel chapter 12. Throughout scripture, the promise is resurrection. Ezekiel chapter 37, I believe, promises you take dry bones, you put the flesh back on, you breathe life back into them. And so our ultimate state will always be an embodied state. And I think losing that sometimes does, unfortunately, cause us to have like this disembodied sense. And I think one of the things that Christianity needs to do is like recapture that. And kind of the best way to do that, I think, ultimately, is by engaging in the Christian life, which is make sure you're in church every Sunday and make sure that you're taking the sacraments, make sure that you're serving the poor, make sure that you're looking out for the physical needs of the people around you. That grounding in this world is so important to the Christian life. And I think, unfortunately, it just, like you said, sometimes just gets lost in endless, you know, spiritual thinking or whatever, but unfortunately a lot of times just gets lost by the distractions of this world. You know, a lot of times what instead we do is we have kind of a basic, real, simple Christianity, and then we distract ourselves with video games or TV shows or social media or whatever, and we don't ever like have that embody itself in our lives. So I think that is that's something that we all need to work on more, because I think Christianity in its fullness is what I'm saying. But I think for all people, myself included, there's so many distractions in this world that don't help us have that fulfillment.
Yeah. I just talked to my priest about the sacrament of confession, and I was a little reticent about it and nervous about it. But now I see how important it is to kind of say, okay, this is where I'm erring, and I will fail. Inevitably I will fail, but I am going to try to correct the path. I'm going to try to be more Christ-like. And there's something very, now that I think about it, there's just something, it's like a relief. It's like, oh, I don't have to carry this burden. I've been, you know, I'm trying, I will fail.
I am
asking for him to, for him to more, be more in me. I make sure I, you know, I go to church, you know, take communion every Sunday for that reason. Like I found that when I don't, I don't feel fortified. I'm much better to handle the adversity that comes my way during the week or,
I
take communion.
I feel like confession is actually exactly what we've been talking about, because it's very easy for us in just a disembodied way to say, sorry, God, you know, sorry, I did that, you know, super sorry about that. It's very easy for us just to say that in our head. It becomes way harder when you have to say it to another person, right?
Yeah.
It becomes way more difficult when you say, you know what, here's what I did. And like, you have to be open and honest. And like, that's that embodied thing that I'm talking about, where it's like, that's the sacrament, that like, that's taking, you know, that spirit world and bringing it into this world and saying, okay, this guy that certainly won't understand, I have to say it too. And it is, it's like a, for me, it's like this very powerful and important thing. I think it's one of the great things the Christian church has done is have that sacrament of confession available to us.
For me, it's just been, I just returned to Orthodoxy about a year ago, and I'm finding it as a gift, but really like an unknown gift, like this secret gift walking around in the world that even Christians don't know about.
Yeah, no, it is. It is, that is a gift. And I think that in some ways it's been forgotten within Protestantism, it's been forgotten. And I think it's so important. And sometimes people will try to recreate it a little bit. They'll have an accountability partner, or they'll have, you know, someone that they'll try and talk to their pastor or whatever. But it doesn't have that same kind of discipline to it that the older traditions have, Catholicism and Orthodoxy have, where it's kind of been set up so that it's a system that effectively works. And I wish more Protestant denominations would consider doing that. I don't know how it would work within there, but like, I think it's such an important thing that we need to have. And I mean, there is of course that element of Christ died for once and for all, but like, it doesn't take away from the fact that you have to constantly be repenting of your sins. You have to constantly be dealing with the fact that you screw up every single day, right? Like that is something that we all have to deal with. Even non-Christians like talk about the fact that, oh, I screwed this up, oh, I treated my kid badly, or I did this, or I really regret what I did to my ex-wife or whatever. And like, so everybody has those regrets and those things they know they screw up. And I think just that process of being able to like go to someone that you know is not going to go blab about it, you know he's not going to go tell everybody about it, and just say, here's what I did and I'm sorry for it, and have kind of this sense that it's now been dealt with, you know, so you can kind of put it behind you. And so I think it's beautiful. So, and ties in, just to get back to our theme, it ties into everything we've been talking about, where it takes it out of the spiritual world and puts it into the physical world.
Yeah. But I also, I think non-believers, if they don't have Christ, and, you know, we're human, we have these pea brains, we have to have a physical entity to put this somewhere. And if you're not giving it to Christ, if you're not saying someone else can take this into the world away, inevitably it falls to this self-help thing. Oh, I can overcome this. I can do this with enough, you know, discipline and control. And what I found and the pitfall, I could never do it on my own. I couldn't make my life better. I was all in on this. I tried so hard to get the things that I wanted out of life. And the focus was so narcissistic and so self-centered. And it never ended up working well.
Yeah. And that is the sad thing about the other paths, the efforts to kind of do it on your own, or the efforts to reach up into heaven on your own, like so many people try and do. And I think that is a sad path because it doesn't work. I mean, ultimately it is destructive. Ultimately it doesn't, it brings ruin rather than fulfillment. And yeah, it is. I agree with you 100% there that ultimately I think Christianity is that true expression of reality. I mean, I think it's right, not just because it seems nice, which I think it does seem nice, and I think it is very cool, and it is a cool process, but it's right also because it's true, also because Jesus Christ really is God, ultimately, because the truths of the Bible are truths. So I think that's obviously what I believe, and I think when people try it, when people test it, they find it too. So it is one of those things that's very hard to, you know, a lot of people spend a lot of time online trying to prove Christianity to people. And yeah. I think there's a place for that, but I also think there's a place for people just trying, you know, just try Christianity, just go to a church, you know, try praying, try reading scripture and just see what happens. And I think for a lot of people, they'll try that and realize this is real. This is truth.
Yeah. I mean, I can say I was very adamant about in my yoga spiritual days of convincing people, right? I talked about it all. Oh, you have to listen to this. I don't know particularly with Orthodoxy, right? Cause we're not like evangelists. I'm talking about it with you. We're having this discussion, but like, I'm not trying to convince anybody anymore, which makes me think that it's true. Like if it's true and you know it's true, you don't have to convince it. They'll figure it out on their own. You know, you encourage people to try it and then you're like, I'm done. You know, I send things to people I know who I can have these conversations with, but I'm not trying to convince anybody.
You know? Yeah, it's like a different, you're operating from a position of confidence, not insecurity, right?
Totally.
Different perspective.
Totally. So I know we could go down this kind of Christianity rabbit hole and it is a big part of the conversation because it's hard to, like you said, for me, and I think if we admit that we're something other than flesh, bones and a bunch of cells tied together, that there is a spiritual impulse to us. But I do want to start to go kind of in the policy direction because you said it's all tied together. And I tell people like I'm now involved in health still. Culture and politics. And everyone's like, how does that all, that doesn't seem anywhat related. But, you know, if we're talking about the health of individuals, the health of a community, the health of our country, right? And a culture, and inevitably we have to get to policy. What do we do about how we litigate, negotiate the use of these drugs in the world? And I think like in your book, you point out is like, if we look at what's happening with marijuana, that's where we're going with these psychedelics, and it's not good.
Yeah. And I think there was a time in my life when I was a pure libertarian, and I, you know, whether regardless of what I thought of drugs, I thought it should be legal. You know, people should just do what they want. And I think a lot of people are in that position where they say, hey, I don't personally smoke marijuana, but it should be legal. Maybe I don't personally do ayahuasca, but I think it should be legal. I think the problem with that, first of all, is that it absolutely does change behavior. If you look at marijuana usage rates, it has spiked incredibly. You know, it's gone from a very, you know, 4%, something like that, up to a majority. Young people, a majority of them do marijuana. A majority of them have done at least tried it, if not regularly doing it. So it's a giant growth. With legalization, and not only growth in terms of how many people, but also growth in terms of how much. There's a book by Alex Berenson called Tell Your Children, and he talks about the fact that the quantity of marijuana being done by your average user now is dramatically higher than it was by your average user 20 years ago. And in part that's due to the THC levels, but also in part that's just due to accessibility. It's legal. You know, so like literally you can walk down the street, buy it and walk back to your house. Like every little town in a state where it's legal has a marijuana shop. So it's so accessible that, and so that people that are using it have now become heavy users. And I think that's true, or going to become true, with other drugs that are being legalized. So California, Oregon, Colorado, even Michigan here, all have movements to try and legalize the use of drugs. And in particular, some of these psychedelic drugs. And I don't see how that couldn't also have the same effect, where more and more people are using them. And it also is just not a personal thing, right? So if you're just, hey, I'll do it. It's not none of your business. I'm going to do the drug or whatever. And you leave me alone, that kind of thing. It's not ultimately a personal thing, because it does impact how you relate to the people around you. It does impact, whether or not you're violent, whether or not you're, doing bad things. And the kind of the premise of my book is that ultimately you are doing something very bad, which is interacting with entities that ultimately are not good entities, ultimately aren't guiding you in the right way. And so by legalizing and saying like half the population now is going to be doing these drugs, and if you take the premise of my book seriously, really you got half the population that are under a very harmful influence. And I don't know how that couldn't affect the rest of us, right? Like, so me saying I'm not going to do it, or my kids aren't going to do it, I don't know how it doesn't affect me that half the population is influenced by this dark entities, these spiritual forces. And so I think from a legal standpoint, I think it's insane to legalize them. I think we're going down a terribly bad road. And that's the premise of my book. But even if you just take like purely, say, non-spiritual reasons, one of the things people talk about with marijuana is that it, nobody is better than alcohol, because nobody ever gets in a fight when they're, or beats their wife when they're high on marijuana. They just chill out, that kind of thing. That is absolutely untrue. That book I mentioned a second ago, called Tell Your Children by Alex Berenson, he talks about the fact that it increases psychosis on a dramatic level. Colorado, when they legalized, they had 5 times the number of people admitted for psychosis in their hospitals the following year. It doubles your chance of getting schizophrenia if you're a regular marijuana user. That's marijuana. So, and the harder psychedelic drugs are even worse for a lot of that stuff. So it absolutely affects your brain state, and then as a result affects violence. So where marijuana gets legalized, where it's regularly used, rates of crime, rates of homicide absolutely go up. It's a myth that everybody that smokes marijuana just chills out on the couch and plays video games or whatever. It simply is not true. People have mental breaks. It leads to paranoid schizophrenia. It leads to other bipolar, et cetera. And absolutely does damage from that. And so even if you reject the premise of my book, which, by the way, my book is absolutely right in every way, but even if you reject that, just the pure scientific studies on the effects of some of these drugs show that they're going to have harmful effects, and they will affect the well-being of everybody, because you can't have half the population doing something that doubles their chance of getting schizophrenia without having negative effects on the system, on crime rates, et cetera. And so as a country, I think we need to turn back from this. And it's interesting, some countries like in Europe, I think England has put the brakes on legalization, where they were going down the same route as us, and they've put the brakes on that. Some countries have dialed back some of the legalized laws as they've seen some of these effects that I'm talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even listen. Again, I appreciate science. I appreciate the studies, because they usually prove what I know is true. And that is, people who take marijuana become stupid. So that, just in general, like, they're not clear-headed. They're numbed out, right? A lot of people take it because they can't deal with the pain, either physical or mental pain of the world, right? And so it just like antidepressants, it changes your body chemistry, so you don't have to deal with what's in front of you, which for me is fine under some circumstances. Some people need that just so they can get by to fix the deeper underlying issue. So I'm not against it completely. I mean, I think that's the, that's like, you know, policy is never an either or situation. It's like, what's the best alternative? It's never a solution. If we had to, if there were a solution, solutions come through communities and families and institutions. Government just says, okay, this is the best alternative so we can all get along. You think this way, I think this way. How are we going to navigate this, right? So policy is never a solution. It's like, it's an alternative. I don't think, like you said, legalizing all of this stuff is a good alternative. I think we really need to look at the studies, but like, I just know in my heart that marijuana, most people that I talk to that are doing it, when they're doing it, are dumb.
Yeah.
Like, they're just out of it. They don't have, you can't see clearly. You can't make clear decisions, which affects everybody, particularly when you're voting.
So. Yeah. No, it definitely dumbs down, but it also, I mean, if you've done marijuana, you know, it makes you paranoid. Right. So it makes you gives like this sense of anxiety and paranoia. And that's a bad place to be when you're paranoid of the people around you. You're walking down the street in the city and maybe you've already got some violent tendencies. And now you think the guy's following you behind you. And like, so, you know, the paranoia can lead to violence. It can lead to bad behavior. It can lead to breaking of relationships. It can lead to, you know, like if I'm smoking weed all the time and I'm paranoid that my wife or my girlfriend is cheating on me, like it's going to amplify that. Every little sign, all of a sudden my brain's going to be linking stuff together and it will lead to a divorce. Or, you know, like if I'm paranoid somebody's stealing from me, I might like physically attack them because my brain is screwed up. So that paranoia is really part of that psychosis that I was talking about. And we've all experienced, anybody that's tried marijuana has experienced that paranoia. It's just like one of the most universal effects of smoking marijuana.
It's interesting because like you, I tried marijuana maybe once really early on. I mean, I've tried one cigarette once in my life. I think it was 15 and I said, never again. Same thing with marijuana. I tried it maybe in my 20s and I was like, oh, this is, I feel stupid. Like I hated it. And so there was just an internal switch. That's not what happened with ayahuasca, you know? So it's interesting. I don't know, the psychedelics. And then of course you've got the Joe Rogans and the Andrew Hubermans and all these people now kind of, I think even Jordan Peterson, you said, kind of touting its benefits. And so I think we just have to be really careful because there is evidence that it can help addiction. It can help PTSD with veterans. I just, if we're going to use it, it needs to be in a very controlled setting. People need to have the tools, and most people that are using it recreationally do not have the tools of how to integrate it back into the real world. And I believe it can become addictive because you do get that high. Everything is beautiful. There's nothing wrong in the world.
Yeah. You know? And I think more skeptical than you of the medical uses of it. I do think that at least surface level, there's, you know, initial studies that show it might help in one category or the other. I do think that it's the medical path is a tool to legalization. That's what they did with marijuana. They said, let's legalize it for medical reasons. And then all of a sudden it's legal for all reasons.
Too easily accessible.
A couple years later. And in the case of marijuana, the medical, supposed medical solutions, if it could be proved medically, then it could just be legalized through the FDA and through a normal way. But in reality, the medical cures that marijuana offers are very minimal. That book I keep mentioning, Tell Your Children by Alex Berenson, he talks about that. But in controlled studies, it really doesn't help much with pain. It really doesn't help much with those. He says it's less effective than Tylenol in terms of dealing with pain.
I was going to say, if it deals with pain, just give them, I mean, don't we have pharmaceuticals for that? That are regulated, highly regulated.
Yeah, and pharmaceuticals have their own problems associated with them. And,
yeah, we can go down that path.
Gotta be careful there as well. But yeah. I think that we'll solve a medical issue by legalizing this. I would say if you are gonna go down that path, which I don't advise, just do it behind the counter like every other drug that don't make it where it's all of a sudden an available thing for people to access. But beyond that, just for the same reasons I've talked about, I think that one of the interesting things about psychedelics that is not necessarily true with all drugs is that it is kind of an inherently spiritual experience.
Mm-hmm.
So when you take LSD or you do magic mushrooms or you do ayahuasca or DMT, you have a spiritual experience. It's not a, you take Tylenol, you don't have a spiritual experience. You,
mm-hmm.
you know, even some, like harder pain medications, a lot of times it gives you a fuzzy head, but you don't have a spiritual experience.
Right.
But you do LSD and you're in the spirit world, like mm-hmm. immediately in the spirit world. And I think that that is concerning if you take that experience seriously. Like if you think that the spiritual experience is just a brain phenomenon, then okay. And I think most people, that's what they think. But the premise of my book is like, that's a real experience. You're experiencing something real. The spiritual experience is an experience of spirits. And I think that's where it's a dangerous thing beyond whatever the controlled study says. You know, the controlled study says this will fix your headache or whatever, you're still interacting with spirits to fix your headache. And so then the question is like, is that a worthwhile trade-off?
Right. What else are you opening yourself up to? Like Pandora, I think you talk about it, Pandora's box, right? It's like you're now opening yourself up to all sorts of dark entities and.
Right. So yeah, it's kind of like I cured your headache, but now you're demon possessed. It's something we need to think about a little bit. And the military, for example, sent out the possibility of psychedelics as a treatment for PTSD
mm-hmm.
To the veterans. A veteran friend of mine sent me an email that he got from the VA on that, and I thought it was crazy, right? That we send people into this place, we damage their brains, and then we try and fix them with psychedelics. Like it seems like an unhealthy cycle of government behavior. That's my concerns with that is that, exactly what I said. I think there's a spiritual element to it that is different than if you're taking a medication that doesn't send you to the spirit world.
Yeah. It's interesting that you mentioned the government. It's like, well, we're going to create the problem. Oh, but guess what? We have the cure too. Kind of like the pharmaceutical industry, you know, we're going to kind of create the addiction and the side effect, but we have something for that too.
Yeah. It's a bad combo of like, let's send you to a horrible war, damage your brain, and then fix you with this spiritual experience inducing drug. And we should be skeptical.
Yeah. Well, and then that points to like, you know, we need to start looking for other solutions and kind of to tie it all together. And I would love to go down the politics realm, but maybe we'll save that for another discussion. But we have to be looking for solutions in our own life. We can't rely on the government. We can't rely on the pharmaceutical industry. And to me, that eventually led me to Christianity, which I'm so grateful for, because it has been the most stabilizing, grounding, and at the same time, uplifting force in my life. And again, I'm not here to convince anybody. I'm just here to share my experience and my experience with the spirit drugs. And
It is, I think to get back to that organized versus disorganized thing, I think Christianity provides that framework for dealing with all your problems, the framework for dealing with ethical questions regarding medicine, that framework for dealing with kind of all the stuff that we've talked about. It's nice to have that organization when it comes to asking these kind of questions, rather than trying to figure absolutely everything out yourself and talking maybe to a guru or talking to this, your, you know, spiritual neighbor or whatever, like, but to be able to have kind of a more stable process where we can ask these questions and get solid answers, I think is a very cool thing.
Yeah, I agree. So I'm going to put links to some of the books that you mentioned, definitely Alex Berenson's. I have a friend of mine who actually was the one who introduced me to you. He wants me to ask you a question. So he's like, and then what, and that's it. And then we're done and you can tell me what you're up to next. But he's the one who actually sent me some of your stuff. And that was probably about a year ago. And, first he wants me to tell you, he loves your book. He's the one who sent me your book
too. Thank you.
Yeah. And, he said, is this plant medicine shit a fad that will fade and start that? Is this a fad that will fade and start to be considered cringe, or is it only just starting?
Yeah, I don't know. I hope that it will. I hope it will fade. You know, I think as a society, we'd be way better off if it did. And it's so hard to tell if a trend is going to be an ongoing trend or if a trend is going to reverse itself. My book and a lot of my efforts are to reverse that trend and to make it so it's a, hey, remember when people used to do those kind of drugs? And that's very, very possible. Hopefully we'll get there. Unfortunately, I don't see that sign of that trend stopping anytime soon. It seems like usage rates, attitudes, legalization, all those things appear to be moving forward with no real voices speaking against them. So I think the answer to that question really depends on you, depends on me, depends on, you know, the voices that are able to speak about this and raise those alarm bells of like, hey, this is not a path we should just sleepwalk down and move towards. So, you know, that's, I know that's not like a confident answer one way or the other, but I'll say, I hope it is short term, but I fear that it might be long term.
Yeah. I mean, I've been ringing the bell. I've had the ear of someone at a very influential think tank, conservative think tank. And I was like, listen, you guys got to watch out for this. This is the next marijuana thing, right? There's just certain, it's okay. Well, we'll just leave them alone. We won't really address it in policy. We're just going to let it go. And then before you know it, the lobbies come in and particularly if there's money to be made off of it, right? That's the other thing that we didn't talk about. But if the pharmaceutical industry can now make money off of this, if they can somehow monetize this, they will. And I think they're about to do that. There's all this research going into it, right? So I said, this is the slippery slope and it's going to be the next thing that everybody's like, yay.
The amount of money in the marijuana industry is wild. It is an amazing amount of money. Billions of dollars. I mean, just incredible amounts of money. And as a result, like there's a lot of incentives for them to just lie. So they lie about the fact that it doesn't cause violence, the lie about the side effects, lie about the mental psychosis, the issues that I brought up. And so they're just willing to, you know, when people come out with studies that show it's harmful, they'll try and publish their own studies to say it's fine. They'll downplay the concerns. If you know the movie Reefer Madness, that gets repeated over and over again by people as a dumb movie from the 1940s or whatever that was poorly acted and kind of ridiculous, that shows some of the side effects of marijuana. By the way, those warnings in that movie, if you take out the bad acting, those warnings were surprisingly true when you actually look at the effects of what marijuana does, especially with psychosis. But that aside, they bring stupid stuff like that up in order to kind of distract people. So if you say, hey, I don't think we should legalize marijuana because it adds to psychosis and it's got other downsides, I say, well, you sound like Reefer Madness. It's ridiculous. You know, nothing wrong with marijuana. You just have fun and, you know, whatever. So there's a huge pro-marijuana lobby. And if you look at the amount of money they've made off marijuana, you think they couldn't make that same amount off of magic mushrooms? You think they couldn't make that same amount selling LSD or ayahuasca trips or whatever? Like they certainly could. And so there's the same incentives that pushed this marijuana to the point where almost every state has legalized or is in the process of legalization, is that I don't see why that same curve wouldn't happen with other drugs.
Yeah. And I think it's more addictive. I mean, because there is a certain, you feel like you're now a spiritual being. People have said, oh, I was an atheist and now I'm not because of psychedelics. And you are messing with something.
You want to know one of the studies, I think it was Johns Hopkins ones. I talk about this in my book, says that a majority of the atheists that took ayahuasca ceased to be atheist. So something like 60% ceased to be atheist.
So even the Christian community could say, or even the religious community could say, well, that's a good thing, right?
Like, yeah, that's,
I mean, so now they're going to get behind it.
Right. That's one of the things like I talk about in my book is like, and I've talked to other people about this on other podcasts. It's like, there's worse things than atheists out there, you know? And like, I think it can get darker than someone kind of intellectually not believing in God. If there's a spiritual element to this, the darker element is rather than being controlled by no spirits, you're being controlled by dark spirits. And I think that's a worse place to be. One of the things we haven't really covered in this conversation that I talk about in my book in depth is why Christianity rejected it. And we talked a little bit about, you know, the spiritual world versus not spiritual world, that kind of thing. But there also is within scripture prohibitions on the use of drugs for spiritual purposes over and over again. And actually to the point of almost seeming unhinged, where it's very strict against the use of pharmakia. And that's the Greek word is pharmakia, and it's often translated like witchcraft or sorcery. And the reason that it gets translated witchcraft or sorcery is because, as I mentioned before, all of the religions back then, all of the witches were utilizing drugs for spiritual purposes. So the word kind of went together. It was both. It was witchcraft and the use of drugs, not because those aren't like two alternate translations, like the word bark could be a tree bark or it could be a dog's noise. It's not like that. It was one word for this kind of use of drugs for spiritual purposes that almost everyone practiced back then.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because that's a big thing. The friend of mine who introduced me to you, he's like pharmakia and all the times that it appears in the Bible, in Revelation, I think even, about how that is the, will be the downfall of humans.
That's the interesting thing. So when we know the story of Jonah, he went to Nineveh. One of the central sins of Nineveh was their pharmakia in scripture. And in the book of, I think it's Nahum chapter 3, it says Nineveh led whole nations astray with their pharmakia. The book of Revelation talks about, I think it's Revelation 18, talks about the fact that pharmakia will lead the nations astray. And so there is this sense that it's not just an individual, you know, we talked about policy. It's not just an individual effect. It will lead whole nations astray. And if you do take into account that spiritual aspect to it, it sort of makes sense, right? Like if 50% of the population is following some spirit world, the mother ayahuasca or whatever, like you're gonna have a whole nation, you know, we're on a democracy, right? So like ultimately 50%
supposedly,
but if 50% of the population is like being led by mother ayahuasca, you're gonna get very different results than if that population is largely Christian or at least sober, right? Like you're very, very different results. And so those warnings of leading whole nations astray, I think should be take it seriously. And I have a chapter in my book that talks about all the nations that did use pharmakia and what happened there, and we talked a little bit about that before in terms of how dark it can get.
Well, the other thing is right, the Bible tells us that bad will be good, evil will be called good, and good will be called evil. I mean, there is nothing more deceptive than something that feels good and makes you think you're spiritually doing a good thing for yourself and healing your trauma, you know, and it's so subversive in that way, because on the surface, like you said, it's a good, it looks like a good thing for a lot of people.
One of the things that I talk about in my book is like when Eve talked to the serpent.
Mm-hmm.
The serpent, by today's standards, did a lot of nice, had a lot of good advice for Eve, right? He was like, take this and you'll become wise. You'll be able to be like the gods. You'll be able to discern right from wrong. You'll be able to mm-hmm. know good and evil. Like that seems like an empowering, cool thing for the serpent to do. And when the devil talked to Jesus, when Jesus was in the desert, the devil offered good things. He said, hey, here's a way to get some bread, and here's a way to get your kingdom. Here's a way, you know, like often in scripture, the demonic forces are actually seem more helpful than the angels. Like angels,
yeah.
People like are terrified by the angels. People like they'll fall, you know, when they see an angel, they fall down out of fear.
Trembling on their knees.
Trembling, right? Angels almost don't, you go through and read all the examples of angels showing up, and almost the first thing they have to say is be not afraid, because they do scare people. And it's the helpful ones that are more the demonic forces. And it's interesting, like people a lot of times will say that with these entities. I'll say, I think these are bad entities. And they'll say, I don't think it could be a bad entity because it did nice things for me. It gave me good advice. You know, Joe Rogan talks about the advice that he got from the machine elves, where they kind of made fun of his insecurities, and he realized, oh, I'm being petty or whatever. So he learned from those entities of how to be a better person. You hear a lot of that, where there'll be like moral lessons or spiritual lessons that people learn. And as a result, they say these must be good entities. And I, you know, those examples I just brought up show that like you can seem good at first and not be good.
Well, you can learn those, and you can learn those moral lessons from the Bible.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't need
yeah.
to go on a trip. I just need yeah. to go, oh, okay. And, yeah, I probably shouldn't have done that.
And then the other thing is, like, I point out to people is, like, you know, in the human world, in the physical world, if someone just shows up and they're real nice to you at first, you don't know if they're actually a nice person, right? They could be running a con on you. You know, if I was a con man, really good con man, I might start off by saying, hey, how can I help you? I'll mow your lawn. You've got cancer. I'll help you go to the doctor and I'll give you this. And you see, all of a sudden you think that Lewis is the nicest guy in the world. And then at the wrong moment, I say, hey, let me just deposit that money in the bank for you. And I clear out your bank account and destroy your life or whatever. And that's what a con man does. Like, that's how cons work. And if we think the spirit world, they can't be just as effective, right? So they can come across as nice at first. That's why people do these drugs, right? They never, you know, if every time you did these drugs, it was like this scary demon that like told you to murder babies or something, like you wouldn't do these drugs. Like nobody would do them. It always starts off as a nice experience.
I was going to say, I've dated a lot of people, guys like that. Always starts very deceptive, very deceptive. Starts off good.
See? Yeah, you've got the experience.
Yeah. So I knew exactly what you were talking about there. I mean, the multitude of ayahuasca experiences I've had, you hear a lot of people screaming. I mean, there's a lot of, there, at least the ones I was in, there was a lot of wow. But again, that's not to defend it at all. I mean, I've done it, and I will strongly caution anyone from staying, to stay away, because I saw where it led me and I see where it's going in society. And ultimately, again, like you said, I just see, like, first it's marijuana, then we're going to have half the nation is going to be drugged up on something if it's not pharmaceuticals, and, you know, and we're all walking around on drugs. Great.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, we're going down that road. And in some ways we've gone down that road a little bit with SSRIs as well, where, mm-hmm. and not to go down another rabbit hole, but like that, there is psychedelic elements to those. And there is kind of a scary aspect to that. And I think that is a concern, that we have so many people doing those and so many people taking those. But yeah, I think that's a huge risk. But I guess my point with the whole, what are the entities, good or bad, and that kind of thing, it's interesting how often that experience changes for people, where it starts off as a better experience than it eventually ends up. And a lot of times that line between sanity and, you know, you mentioned this with you, this line between sanity and psychosis mm-hmm. starts to become blurred with these. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's just a side issue. I think that's part of this whole spiritual thing. And so I think it's, I think it is a giant risk that we're running. And it's, in my mind, it's like almost hard to overstate it, especially given how like full speed ahead as a culture we are on these things. It's almost like, I can't believe we're going down this road. Like, I can't believe we're just marching down this road without any kind of real reflection on this issue. The Western civilization worked very hard to not have these drugs as part of society. That's what people don't realize is, like, as I mentioned, so many religions had these. Christendom worked to get rid of these. Those popes that made statements against cannabis, this was pushed out of society on purpose. And just like Pandora's box, you know, it's being opened right back up and being done almost with no thought, being done, you know, with no reflection, no debate. It's just, we're doing it. And it just seems insane to me.
Well, it follows suit because people are attacking Christianity, right? So when you attack that, then you're like, well, you have no ground to stand on because we don't believe in you. So when you attack the institutions, you're going to not believe the doctrines that come out of those institutions. So, you know. Yeah.
Yep. No, that's true. And it's, that's a problem. And I don't know that you can, I don't know what there is to do about it other than exactly what we're doing is talk about it and bring it to people's consciousness. But I think beyond that, it seems like a difficult place for us as a society. With that being said, I feel like miracles happen all the time and changes happen all the time in cultures. I think in some of these things we've talked about, it's been a change for the worse. I think you can have things turn around and be a change for the better. I think it's very possible for things to flip directions. And so, you know, I'm hopeful and I'm working for that.
Yeah. And to end it on a positive note, I mean, I think regardless of what, where culture is going, right? We see it going down the slippery slope. That article I sent to you, I don't know if you read it about, you know, here come the clowns. It's like, it just seems, I have this discussion a lot with some of my friends in conservative circles. And it's like, is this an inevitable, right? Are we just fighting, are we just kind of mitigating the slow march to destruction? And even if that's the case, then at least we know we're living our lives in accordance with the way we should, and we're doing our best to bring awareness. And then at the end of the day, it's in God's hands. We know who wins ultimately, whether we're part of that victory or not. You know, we're here to see that victory. Like Moses didn't see the victory, right? So,
yeah, you go through history and there's been a lot of times when Christians have had to go through hard times. I mean, you think of the communist revolution in mm-hmm. Russia that mm-hmm. all those Christians had to go through. There's many times when it's just, we're in a bad spot. We're going to be in a bad spot for a few generations. You remain faithful. You do your best to survive it and you get through it. And it is like there is that beautiful aspect to Christianity that is the resurrection, that we don't need to ultimately worry about our current state, that in the end we will be raised up, in the end everything will be put to right. And so it is, there is a beautiful hope that there is out there, but it can be a little scary and a little difficult in the short term, we can get through it and we can survive it. And I feel like you always, to some degree or another, you always have those battles. C.S. Lewis talks about that in That Hideous Strength. I don't know if you've read that book, but it's a beautiful prophetic book about kind of in so many ways about today, like what we're going through mm-hmm. today. And at the end of it, there's like this miraculous turning back. So everything's going down this bad path of society. And then at the end, there's like this miraculous act of restoring England. It's kind of a dystopian novel that's going in this dystopian way. And then at the end, there's this miraculous turning back. And C.S. Lewis talks about, he says, England has always had this battle, that every generation deals with their own battle. Every generation could either go really horribly bad or restore itself. And that's just generationally, that's always going to happen. And so this is what the battle we've been called to fight.
Right.
Like the issues, not just drugs, but there's so many other issues. You know, we talked about other social issues. Like there's so many things we're dealing with right now as a society. And it is a turning point in history, but in some ways, every generation has had to deal with these.
Yeah.
You go back and our parents' generation or the generation before them, everyone had their battles to fight. And there's something also awesome about knowing where you have to fight and what you're supposed to do and doing your best. And, you know, if it goes, as long as we're fighting that fight, we can leave the results to God. And he is able to ultimately win his own battles. But I think we're just called to do what we're called to do.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you being in the fight. Thank you for your time. So what's next and where can people find you?
So probably the best way to read what I am working on is my Substack, which is lewisungit.substack.com. So people should check that out. Free subscription right now. So get free articles. I probably write one article a month, so I'm not writing a ton, and most of that is because I do most of my time researching, and then when I come to a conclusion on something, I'll write about it. But recently I've been writing a lot about technology and the kind of interaction of religion and technology, which I think is also a very interesting overlap, and it has many of the same aspects that we've been talking about here with drugs and religion. There's some similar things when it comes to technology. So I've written quite a bit on that. That's probably my next book will probably be on that question of what does technology look like from a spiritual standpoint? What does it mean to be using AI? What does it mean to be have cell phones in front of us all the time and that kind of thing? Mm-hmm. So people can check that out. I write about that on my Substack. And other than that, yeah, just check out my book. Everything we talked about here, I go into way more depth in that book. So it's Return of the Dragon. And if you say Return of the Dragon, you might get like a Bruce Lee movie. So if you put my last name on Amazon, you'll find it. So Ungit, U-N-G-I-T. It will pop up. But thank you so much for having me on. This was a great fun conversations. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I appreciate it. And I'll put all the links in the show notes too. So thanks for your time and all the best to you.
Yeah, thanks so much.
I am so glad I had the chance to speak with Lewis about all the fun stuff, you know, drugs, religion, politics, very uncontroversial. But I hope you learned something and it sparked your curiosity to understand psychedelics a bit better and why they may not be the silver bullet many are claiming. By the way, I hope the intermittent banging sounds weren't too much of a distraction. Lewis and I were both aware of it, but he was undergoing some house renovations, and as you know, when those guys come, if you tell them not now, they may never show up again. So we went for it. Anyway, thanks for sticking it out. If you're enjoying the podcast, I would be tickled if you would give it a 5-star rating and say something nice in the comments to those peeps at Apple or wherever you listen. And of course, the biggest compliment you can give is sharing this with a friend. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time. Until then, stay connected.